Hello from London. I'm here with my family in our old home, recording the beginning of this new series on Paul's letter to the Romans. You know, they used to say the sun never sets on the British Empire. And that was true because it was in nearly every time zone, back in the 19th century anyway. But if we go back much further to the Rome of the 2nd century or even the time of Christ, Rome was supreme, capital of the Western world. This is the first podcast in a series of 26, which I am calling Romans A to Z, although with deference to the British, I should probably say Romans A to Z, as they put it. Rome was not only the capital of the Western world, it was an enormous city, population 1 million, a city of culture, some of their own, much of it stolen from the Greeks, a city of entertainment. Think of the gladiators, think of the chariot races, a city of architecture and engineers, the rich and the poor, an important city. And yet, it had not begun, the Christian mission here had not begun through an apostle. It had happened in a very informal, grassroots way. We'll come to that in a moment. As in this first lesson, we go over the first half of chapter 1. Romans is Paul's longest letter. It's similar to Galatians for reasons that we will take a look at soon enough. It's written probably in 53 AD. Let's begin with the text. Each lesson, I'm hoping, will make a great daily meditation, personal devotion, or quiet time. And I want to be practical, but I think it'll be even more practical if we do our homework and really flesh out the background. So, verse 1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Now, I'll pause there, even though the first sentence is quite a bit longer than that. Let's unpack this. Paul introduces himself not only as a servant or slave of Jesus Christ, he often does that, but he mentions his apostleship. And that's not something that he normally does, and when he does do it, it's only with a certain reluctance. Well, why is this? Well, Paul has no real authority in Rome. They've probably heard of him, but he's never been to Rome, as he later admits. He did not start the church in Rome. He is reminding them, therefore, of who he is. He may not be one of the 12 original apostles, but he is an apostle. He may not have planted the church in Rome. That was probably started by Jews attending the services of the temple in Jerusalem. We'll read about them in Acts 2, verse 10. At the day of Pentecost, they were pilgrims from Rome present. They would have gone back to Rome, and as long as some of them were among the thousands baptized, that seems a fair assumption, then the seeds for Christianity, the kernel for the Christian movement to take root in Roman soil, had been created. And so it seems that that's how the church started. In fact, I know a lot of us who like to plant churches have mission societies and grand plans, have our strategies and our timetables and all of our ideas. Yet so often, the best missions happen just when, well, someone is forced to move because of his job. Someone has to move because of her family. Someone becomes a Christian fairly quickly and goes on to another part of the world, and things happen in a grassroots way. That's really the way Christianity spreads, certainly in the early centuries and even today. So Paul had not planted the church personally, but it doesn't mean that he had no claim because he was, in fact, an apostle. So he's writing to the church in Rome. We might think of them as all meeting in a single building. It's doubtful because, according to the evidence of the New Testament, the Christians usually met in homes. So he's probably writing to a network of house churches in Rome. And if you want to know the names of some of the prominent persons or the house church leaders, you can find that in the final chapter of Romans, chapter 16. Paul had not planted the church in Rome, but he would go there in time. And there's good evidence, good archaeological evidence, that he's buried there, as is Peter. So he reminds them of who he is, and he says that this gospel was promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Now, verse 2, that's the second verse of a letter, mirrors the next to the last verse in Romans, where he speaks the proclamation of Christ, now revealed and made known through the prophetic writings by the command of the eternal God. That's interesting. If you go back two verses from the end or forward two verses from the beginning, you get the same idea that this great message was in the Scriptures. Of course, that means the Old Testament. The gospel concerning a son who was descended from David according to the flesh, declared to be Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. Now, there are two sides of Jesus that Paul emphasizes, one the human, the other the divine. In terms of his humanity, he's a descendant of David, kind of the point that's made in the beginning of Matthew 1. He's the Messiah. He's the Jewish Messiah. Paul's not writing to a particularly Jewish city, though there were lots of Jews in Rome. It's a mainly Gentile group, a non-Jewish group. The Christ was descended from David, but he's also Son of God. And that phrase, Son of God, was applied to the emperor. I did a series earlier this year, Christ Through the Ages, earlier this year. I'm giving it away. In 2014, we started the year with a series, Christ Through the Ages. And we looked at how terms normally applied to the emperor are all applied to Jesus. So it's a little bit subversive. The emperor could be referred to as Son of God, but here it's Christ who's the Son of God. He's the one that we have to give our full loyalty to. Well, how is he declared to be the true Son of God, the true King of Kings and Lord of Lords, to use the language of Revelation? Well, this happens through the Spirit of holiness by resurrection. So you can see that in this opening paragraph, as Paul introduces himself and the gospel, the language is packed, it's tight, it's very dense. Jesus Christ, through whom we have received grace and apostleship, there's that emphasis again, but for a purpose, to bring about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles for the sake of his name. I just read 1:5. Once again, I'd like to flip to the very end of Romans. And this is in Romans 16, yet again, and the same verse, verse 25, the one that spoke of the message being in the prophets. It continues, so that all nations might believe and obey. This is good stuff. You see, obedience comes from faith. In the New Testament, faith and obedience are never separated. Not like, I'm sad to say, so many modern evangelicals who equate obedience with law and say that today you don't have to obey, you just have to have faith. No, true faith always leads to obedience, to a change in life. And Paul frames the epistle to the Romans with that truth, but also with another. Because the obedience of faith, it will be preached among all the Gentiles. And once again, at the very end of Romans, he says, so that all nations, or you could render that all Gentiles or all peoples, might believe and obey him. So obedience is really what shows true faith to be genuine, and it's going to take place among all nations, all the Gentiles. It's this grand Old Testament theme of God doing something wonderful in the world, and not just for one people, the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and particularly Jacob, but among every nation in the globe. Now, this is an exciting theme. It's something that moves me and helps me to think globally, even though I must act locally. It's a great theme. Let's continue with the introduction to Romans. Then he says, including yourselves, he's just referred to obedience to faith. He says, including yourselves who are called to belong to Jesus Christ, to all God's beloved in Rome who are called to be saints. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, he's just said that among the Gentiles, God is making a people for himself, a people of the Christ, the Messiah, and they're obedient. And he says, including yourselves. Now, that original group of Christians in Rome would have been Jewish because they were Jews when they went to Jerusalem in Acts 2. They returned as Jews. Well, they returned as Jewish Christians. And sometimes we forget, I think, we Christians forget, that Christianity was viewed by Jews, by the Roman government, by everyone, as kind of a flavor of Judaism. Christians were a sect of the Jews. And so not only were they culturally Jewish, and this was their background, they had the Jewish scriptures and many traditions, but even governmentally, they had certain protections. Ah, but something had happened in Rome just a few years before Paul wrote Romans. And that is that the Emperor Claudius, he reigned up until the year 54. Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. Well, since the Jews included Christians, I think this shows that a number of Christians were expelled from Rome. In fact, we know that happened to people like Aquila and Priscilla. We read the book of Acts. They had been in Rome and they were kicked out because of the decree. That was in the approximately the year 50, just before Paul wrote Romans. So the number of Jewish Christians may have been smaller. Probably the relative number of Gentiles was greater. And Paul will remind them later on that those Gentile Christians, in a sense, were grafted in onto the Jewish stock. So it includes themselves, but he's writing now to a much more Jewish congregation or series of congregations than he would have been before this decree of Claudius that the Jews, who were often picked on by outsiders, before the Jews were expelled from Rome. What else need to say about this? Let's just keep going. So he says, to all God's beloved in Rome called to be saints. In the previous verse, he said, you're called to belong to Jesus Christ. Well, but that's what a saint is. It's belonging to Jesus Christ. It's not someone who has done a miracle and lived a virtuous life and is dead. A saint is a term used in many New Testament passages to refer to a Christian. And the emphasis, of course, is on holy living, living a saintly life. So this is his introduction, verses 1 to 7. One other thing remains to be said, and we know where the audience are, they're in Rome, but where is Paul at this time? Where is Paul writing his letter? To really understand what's going on for any of the letters or for Acts, in fact, I think it's true for the Gospels, you have to know a little bit of the geography and the history. I hate it when people think that geography and history aren't interesting. This is the only way we can read the Bible in living color. Otherwise, it's a bit flat. It's a bit black and white. We have to know a bit of history, where Rome is. Rome, of course, is quite a bit west of Greece, and that's where Paul is when he's writing Romans. How do I know? Well, in 16:1, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church in Cenchrea. Corinth had two harbors. One harbor was at Cenchrea, just as, you know, Rome had a harbor, Ostia. That was its port. Corinth actually had two. When Paul commends Phoebe, Phoebe must in some way be connected with the Romans. Either she's going to visit them, or she was originally Roman, and now she's in Cenchrea, that is Corinth. But he says, I ask you to receive her in the Lord. Phoebe is on the way to Rome. Maybe she's even the one delivering the letter. She's a servant of the church in Cenchrea. I mean, there's so much to say here. Many of Paul's colleagues were women, whereas Jesus and Paul brought great dignity and freedom, liberation to women, and much more than they received even in the Old Testament, although that was a huge improvement on the pagan world. Yet sadly, in the second century, the church goes backwards. It slips back into patriarchy. Oh, there's a lot to be said here. Okay, but my point is where Paul is located when he writes a letter. So he mentions Cenchrea, and then there's another verse in chapter 16, verse 23. He says, Erastus, who is the city's director of public works, sends you greetings. Well, Erastus was the director of public works at Corinth. In fact, there's an archaeological inscription, a huge pavement dedicated by Erastus. And so we know that he was at Corinth, and that's where Paul was. So every letter has a destination, but also has an origin. Romans is for Rome, but it's written from Corinth. Paul is on the move, and he wants to go to Rome, which is west, but first he has to go east, and he'll explain this soon. I thank my God through Jesus Christ, verse 8. I thank God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is proclaimed throughout the world. For God, whom I serve with my spirit in announcing the gospel of his Son, is my witness that without ceasing, I remember you always in my prayers. Asking that by God's will, I may somehow at last succeed in coming to you. For I'm longing to see you, that I may share with you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, or rather so that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. Here Paul indicates his desire to visit Rome. At long last, he's starting to think, this is going to happen. It's going to work out. Why did he want to go to Rome, this important city whose faith was proclaimed around the world? It was no backwater. And the city that would, of course, in the near future, be the most significant Christian city. What were Paul's purposes in going there? Well, he says that he would like to share with them some spiritual gift. And then he qualifies that and says, well, actually, I don't want to just give something to you. There's something I'm hoping for from you. Oh, now what would that be? First, a comment on the spiritual gift. There are a couple ways to look at that. Maybe he's saying, I want to be a blessing to you by teaching you, being with you, filling you in on what I know, sharing my faith with you, answering your questions, just a more general kind of blessing to them. I mean, I hope that when I travel around the world, when my colleagues, brothers and sisters, travel around to all the continents to encourage Christians and to preach to groups of seekers, I hope that that helps them. It strengthens them. That's my purpose. Oh, I'm no apostle. So it's very easy to imagine that Paul would expect to do this. Now, perhaps he means something different. Maybe he's talking about giving them some miraculous spiritual gift. Paul makes an interesting point in 1 Corinthians 1, I believe it's verses 5 to 7, that because he had spent time in Corinth quite a bit, they lacked no spiritual gift. Now, of course, most of the spiritual gifts are not miraculous at all. They're things like leadership or administration. But some of the spiritual gifts were miraculous. So maybe he's saying, well, in Corinth, I was, as an apostle, I was present for some time, and many of you have received spiritual gifts. But I've never been to Rome. No apostle had been to Rome yet. Even Peter perhaps had never been to Rome at this time. And Paul's saying, I'm going to give you some miraculous spiritual gift. That's possible. I could see it going either way. As a younger Christian, I was somewhat dogmatic. It must be a miraculous spiritual gift. But I can see that going either way. Either way, it will be an encouragement to all. So what is Paul's purpose in visiting them? Besides strengthening them, what is he hoping to receive? Well, there's a practical purpose and there's a theological purpose. We'll talk about the theological purpose more next time, a purpose of heading off trouble, because all is not happy and calm in the Christian movement. There are bad things happening on the other side of the empire. In the Eastern Mediterranean, there's confusion and trouble. And there was a whole council in Jerusalem to talk about this. And this explains why the earlier letter of Galatians is so similar to Romans, although so passionate. And there's a theological reason that we'll return to next time. But I want to look at the practical purpose. Okay, I don't want to lose you here. We could say that the purpose of his visit to Rome was missionary, but the purpose of the letter was theological. And we'll explain the theological thing next time. But the purpose of the visit was missionary. Well, how so? Well, I have to go again to the end of Romans. After he's explained the gospel message and given many practicals, he says in 15:23, "Now there's no more place for me to work in these regions." Oh, Paul has just been speaking about his work in the Eastern Mediterranean, and now so he's headed to the Western Mediterranean. He said, "There's no more place for me to work. Since I've been longing for many years to see you, I plan to do so when I go to Spain." Okay, so Paul has been at the other end of the Mediterranean. Think of Antioch, the principal Antioch of Syria, on the eastern end of the Mediterranean, Spain on the western end, Rome in the middle. So Paul wants to go to Spain, and Rome is on the way. If you sail a certain way, it's right on the way. It says, "I hope to visit you while passing through and have you assist me on my journey there after I've enjoyed your company for a while. Now, however, I'm on my way to Jerusalem in the service of the saints there." Then he says, "Macedonia and Achaia," we might say northern and southern Greece, "they were pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem." And he says, "After I've completed this task," and what he's doing is delivering money that he's been collecting from Gentile Christians, and he's going to take it to Jerusalem and give it to the leaders there, and this will be for famine relief among poor Jews and poor Christians. He's going to deliver this money, this gift, which he even calls fruit in the next verse, "and then I will go to Spain and visit you on the way. I know that when I come to you, I will come in the full measure of the blessing of Christ." Paul is asking for financial assistance. He's not asking for a lot, but for enough to get to Spain. The early church had an expectation that missionaries would be taken care of with housing, food, and support for travel. Not that they were unwilling to work themselves and save money. Paul is a tent maker. But it was just right to send the brothers on their way with that kind of support. We read about this in many New Testament passages. For example, 1 Corinthians 9 or the little letter of 3 John. So Paul wants to go to Spain and he wants missions money from the Romans so that he can do it. That's the practical purpose. The theological purpose of his letter we'll look at later. Let's just read the last couple verses in the intro. "I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as I have among the rest of the Gentiles." See, Paul views the Romans primarily as a Gentile community. There were Jews. We know that because of Acts 2:10. But at this point, they're primarily Gentile. Then he says, "I am a debtor to both Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and the foolish. Hence, my eagerness to proclaim the gospel to you also who are in Rome." And this theological purpose has something to do with Jews and Gentiles. Join us in the second podcast as we examine the theme of Romans. The whole lesson will be just on verses 16 and 17. And then after that, we'll be set up and prepared to tackle the rest of the letter. Thanks for listening.